the Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. John Fox and Dan Bockrath are the original co-publishers of Cincinnati City Beat, the city's alternative weekly. They joined me last Friday to talk about the publication's legacy on the occasion of its 25th anniversary. And joining me now are John Fox and Dan Bockrath. They were co-publishers back in 1994 when the very first City Beat rolled off the presses and was distributed across the Queen City. John, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
And Dan, welcome to you.
Good to see you again, Michael.
Well, first, take us back to 1994 and how this crazy experiment got started, John.
Well, it was before cell phones. It was before the internet. I mean, we would print out the pages and we would run it through a waxer and we'd paste it on boards and we would hang it up on the wall to read everything. I mean, it sounds like we were cavemen.
But just the whole idea of launching a new alternative weekly newspaper, how did that get in your head?
Well, I was the editor of the existing alternative weekly called Everybody's News, and I'd been doing that for 3 years. But I had met Dan in some ways. Dan was out in San Diego at the paper out there, and he had shown me what bigger cities were doing and how it was a profitable business. It was really making a difference in these communities. And I felt like Everybody's News was just not doing what we could do. Wasn't making much of an impact. The people who owned it weren't really taking it very seriously. So like a lot of people, I thought, well, either I can give up my dream of running a newspaper or I can go across the street and start my own. Back then, you know, we were only a couple of years after the Mapplethorpe trial. We were really struggling with any kind of alternative or progressive sorts of points of view. You know, we always had a great art scene and a great music scene, but in terms of politics or just thinking about issues like community police issues or racial issues or sexual identity issues, I mean, we were like back in the caveman days. And so we just thought, God, we really need an alternative voice here in Cincinnati to just start to push some of these different ideas. And, you know, again, you look 25 years later and pretty much everything that we covered and pushed
stood for
is now mainstream. It's hard to believe.
I have Volume 1, Issue 1 framed in my study. And the headline, I can still remember as clear as yesterday, toe-to-toe and over the Rhine, with a pair of ratty gym shoes facing square up to a pair of very nice dress shoes, and it was all about the issues of gentrification and over the Rhine. This is 1994. Yeah. And here we are 25 years later. That's still part of the conversation. So we didn't necessarily begin that conversation in 94, but it was certainly an example of our progressive ideals and as an urban weekly, the voice that we wanted to give to those without a voice. And John delivered on that mission from day one. It was just a perfect partnership for what we wanted to do with City Beat.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We're talking with John Fox and Dan Bockrath, the original co-publishers of City Beat, celebrating its 25th anniversary this year. And John, you noted the climate, political climate, environmental climate of Cincinnati and its surrounding area back in 1994, which was so much more notoriously conservative. How did you find a way to establish credibility in a market that was more trusting of the establishment media personalities?
Well, what we decided pretty early on was that in everything that we covered, we were going to really give it a youthful spin. So we were, you know, we just thought that younger people don't really care what older people are talking about or thinking about. But older folks are always interested what younger people are thinking about because they're sort of the trendsetters. So whenever we had an opportunity, we'd always go young in terms of the kinds of music we covered, the kind of arts we covered, kind of politics we covered. So we would always try to find the 20-something political person who didn't have a shot in heck to get on city council, but they were running anyway, and we would just put them on the cover and just say, you should vote for this person because they've got some great ideas. And same with bands, the same with artists, the same with people who were starting nonprofits. It was always about what's next. And, you know, a lot of times those things didn't really amount to anything, but every now and then we would hit, you know, like I remember one of my favorite things was Mark Mallory was in the state legislature at the time. And his father had been famous in town as a state legislator as well. And he decided he was going to run for mayor. But hardly anybody really knew him. They knew the Mallory name. But if he was elected, spoiler alert, he was.
Twice.
He would have been the first directly elected African-American mayor of Cincinnati. And so we jumped on that bandwagon very early on. We interviewed him a lot. We talked about him a lot. And I remember I got some pushback because people thought that we were, you know, maybe being a little too out there with our picks. But we ended up being the only media outlet that endorsed him, and he ended up winning and he became mayor. And I just, you know, did he change the city by himself? I don't know. But I just think those are examples of ideas that we tried to get behind that, again, some worked, some didn't. But in the big picture over time, the city does change.
And I would add to that that you know, part of our branding strategy was that we appealed as much to a state of mind as we did to an age group. And, you know, we felt that there was a need for a progressive voice in the community that was dominated by the WLWs and the Inquirers and the more traditional media outlets, and we were that alternative voice. And so we appealed to what we felt was an enlightened audience. And I think the fact that we appealed to an enlightened audience, they were very appreciative of that. And so that meant, in addition to capturing the interests of the 20-somethings who were consuming the publication for places to go and things to do, we had a more mature audience that had an affinity for the arts that appreciated our more enlightened arts coverage. The way Rick Pender wrote reviews of theater, the way we did our arts coverage, which we felt was far superior than the content that would even appear in the daily newspaper. So I think that allowed us to build an audience that covered both a younger spectrum as well as a more educated spectrum that appreciated what we were publishing. But we had a target audience that was appealing to advertisers. We made a very intentional effort to secure. I remember going in, one of my first business meetings was with the two owners of Bogart's and sitting in their office and asking them to be one of our charter advertisers. And the same with Riverbend. We wanted to own that music and nightlife advertising marketplace and the restaurant advertising, because that was complementary to the audience that we reached. In some ways, the ads were an extension of our content. And so there was a real affinity there with our audience in that area. They were the people who had the discretionary income to buy concert tickets, to go out to eat, to see movies. And back in those salad days in the first 5 or 6 years, and we were running 80-page papers with cigarette ads and ads for vodka and plenty of concert advertising. Back when the movie companies used to run print ads, when 6 movies would open on a Friday, they would have ads in our paper because our readers were picking up City Beat for places to go and things to do, and that's where they wanted to be. So it took a while to build that up, but once we got our brand established and the editorial content that John was responsible had a lot to do with that, the advertising naturally fell into place. And those first 5 or 6 years, we even with the advent of the internet in 97, and little did we know what the fallout of all that was going to be at the time. But leading up to 2001, we were hitting all of our targets on our business plan. And then in 2001, we had racial unrest and Over the Rhine, and then 9/11, and that served as a bit of a setback. That was one of the few setbacks we encountered in our initial growth phase. We rallied from that when things kind of reverted to normal. We were getting back in sync, and then the Enquirer decided they wanted to launch a faux alt weekly called Sin Weekly.
I remember Sin Weekly,
and Gannett was doing these in other markets, and they
were shredded for that though.
They took a scorched earth policy with advertising though. I mean, they were selling full page ads for less than what we were selling, like quarter page ads for. Yeah. They really intentionally, you know, even though they would never admit it, set to put us out of business. Yeah. And capture the same restaurant and nightlife advertising that we had comfortable relationships with. So they did some damage in Indianapolis and in Louisville with their products there, but we dug in with the music scene and Mike Breen, who was our music editor from day one, we were not going to give ground there, and our advertisers stayed loyal with us. So it was there was a little bit of a damage because we had to reinvest in marketing and promotion and some additional circulation to fight them off. So they did draw a little blood, but and that was a bit of a problem. But we persevered, but it was definitely another setback that we had to deal with through our growth period. So it was starting to become a bit of a roller coaster ride by then.
And that's Dan Bockrath, one of the co-publishers throughout a long period of City Beat's history, and certainly at the beginning in 1994 when this 25-year-old alternative weekly was first published. We're also joined by John Fox, the fellow co-publisher who was in charge of the editorial side. And John, I suppose in a way, even you would have to admit that Turnabout is fair play, because City Beat was certainly an antagonist towards the Cincinnati Inquirer. It was literally an alternative to that paper, right?
Yeah.
And one very significant moment in the Cincinnati Inquirer's history happened in the late 1990s.
I know what he's going to say.
And is also a significant part of City Beat's history. And it involves bananas.
Mm-hmm.
And that was before we used that term as something to reference crazy things.
Right.
But this was a crazy thing in journalism. Yeah. And that it was happening here, it was quite a spectacle involving legacy media, newer media, and really one of the most powerful rich guys in town.
Yeah.
Well, so tell us about the Chiquita scandal.
Yeah, it still resonates for all those reasons. But the Enquirer had two really good reporters that they had put on this story, and they spent about a year working on a story that would investigate Chiquita, because Chiquita was headquartered here at the time because Carl Lindner had bought controlling interest and had moved the headquarters here. So, and Carl Lindner, everybody knows who he is, but he also ironically had owned the Enquirer at one point and had sold it to Gannett. So anyway, they went down to Central America. They went to all the Chiquita banana plantations. They interviewed workers. They interviewed government officials in a bunch of these countries. They interviewed about paramilitary groups that had been hired by Chiquita to keep the workers in line, and also to be in cahoots with the government folks. And it was just a lot of corruption. A lot of people were getting killed. Workers were getting abused. And they ended up producing this huge 16, 18-page section that was in a Sunday Enquirer one Sunday in 1998. And it was amazing. I mean, they had pictures of, I mean, I still remember there was a guy who held up his shirt and he had a bullet hole where he'd been shot by one of Chiquita's security guys in Honduras or something like that. And anyway, and then they at the end of it, they tied Carl Lindner into it, because Carl Lindner was very well respected, very well liked businessman, but they were kind of really dishing on the fact that he ran this company and that all the officials, the higher ups at Chiquita, knew this was going on, even though they said they didn't. But they found out. The reporters found out that they did know what was going on. So they write this huge story, this big section. It lands like an atomic bomb. And then all of a sudden, a couple of Sundays later in the Enquirer, on the front page of the Enquirer, is this huge boxed above the fold. It says, "An apology to Chiquita." They ran it for 3 days in a row, and they basically took everything back. They said, "Never mind. Everything we just said about how bad Chiquita is and Carl Lindner and all the officials at Chiquita, just forget that we said anything. We're going to take it back."
And they renounced. They
renounced the story. They took. They scrubbed it from their website. They all the physical copies of it that were in their library internally were all thrown away. Anyway, they took it all back, and so the Enquirer couldn't write about it. The Post was still around at the time, and they tried to write about it, but I don't know if anybody remembers, but the Post and the Enquirer were in a joint operating agreement. They were business partners, so the Post really wasn't going to delve into it too deeply.
Well, the Enquirer handled the Post sales.
Yeah, they did all the business functions and distribution. The Post still had their own editorial staff. Anyway, we just thought, well, what in the world is going on here? And so people from the Enquirer started calling me and telling me what was going on behind the scenes, how the rank and file at the Enquirer were not being told about what was going on. It was completely tight-lipped. It went all the way up to Gannett in Washington. One thing led to another. Anyway, I started writing stories about it because there was nobody else to cover it. And people were coming to town from national journalism publications like Columbia Journalism Review and Editor and Publisher, and they were literally parachuting into town to cover this huge journalism story, and nobody locally was talking about it. So we did, got a lot of good information, and it led to one of my professional highlights, which was one day I got a call from NPR, and they said, "We'd love to have you on Morning Edition with Bob Edwards to talk about this." And so I came over here to the studios over here, and they put me in a studio with a headphone on and one morning, and here came the voice of God, Bob Edwards. And he interviewed me on the radio, live, nationwide, to talk about the story. And I was scared to death, but I think I did okay. And it was, you know, it just helped. The reason I liked doing it, I mean, I felt bad because it was a bad story and people were getting hurt by this story. What was good about it was I was hoping that people would understand that there was somebody in Cincinnati that was trying to get to the truth of this story, and that all of us were not just idiots in flyover country, but there was actually a couple of people here who A, thought that this was really wrong, and B, were going to try to figure out what was going on. And so it was great. And that was it was an interesting time. I later found out a lot of like the real details of what happened, and somebody eventually slipped me. I actually have a copy of the actual signed agreement between Chiquita and Gannett.
We always took great pride in being a voice of the people and serving those who are underserved in our community. And we were locally owned and independently operated until we sold to a boutique publishing group in 2012. But, you know, we kind of had a little bit of a stick it to the man attitude. Mm-hmm. And I think the fact that we championed small business and supporting mom and pop shops. Yeah. In fact, Tracy Walker wrote a song about it. It was mm-hmm. part of a mm-hmm. marketing campaign that we did. You know, I'm very proud of that legacy. And we stood up to the powers that be that wanted to put us in our place, like a chief of police, like Citizens for Community Values, who teamed up with Charlie Winburn and tried to tell us what kind of advertising we couldn't accept. That was probably the defining point that crystallized for me the relationship that we have with our audience, the relationship we have with our readers. We actually had a rally on Fountain Square. You know, our advertisers were with us, our readers were with us, and we basically put Citizens for Community Values and Charlie Winburn and City Hall in their place. You can't tell us what we can and cannot publish. And I think that was probably the one defining moment that probably represents our legacy.
The 90s were so fun, weren't they?
Oh, just a joy. Smash Mouth, the whole thing.
Smash Mouth. It's the one band you get to reference here is Smash
Jimmy,
Mouth.
Jimmy
all
Buffett.
The 90s.
Yeah. We were the only publication that made fun of Jimmy Buffett. Everyone just loved it when he came to town.
That is courage in Cincinnati, and that is definitely
was 20
your
years
legacy.
Ago.
Okay, John Fox, Dan Bockrath, the original co-publishers of Cincinnati City Beat, have been my guest here at City Beat, Best of Cincinnati, favorite radio station, 91.7
Yay!
WVXU.
Yeah.
Thanks to both of you for being in
here. Awesome, Michael. Thank you.
Thanks.
After our interview, Dan Bockrath emailed me to say that what really mattered to City Beat was making a difference in the community. He said, quote, "If by virtue of City Beat's existence, more people went to a club to experience a local band, or went to an art gallery opening, or voted in an election, then we were doing our part to make a difference." This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Cincinnati City Beat is celebrating its 25th anniversary. There are newer hands guiding the ship now. I spoke earlier with the current publisher and managing editor. And joining me now is City Beat publisher Tony Frank. Welcome, Tony.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
And we also have with us managing editor and music editor Mike Breen. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Michael.
Mike, I understand you've been with City Beat a pretty long time.
Ever since the first issue,
the very first issue.
25 years
ago. So what does 25 years of this publication mean to you?
Really, I always say I'm really proud of it, but it's, you know, I started out doing all the music stuff and have done the music stuff for 2.5 decades now, and I'm proud of that, but I'm more proud of what the paper represents and kind of the progress we've got to document in the city. So, yeah, mostly just pride. I'm very happy to have been and still be there. So,
and music is a really key piece of what City Beat is. In addition to covering news, you've been a place for local musicians to be highlighted for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that important?
I think you can kind of judge a city's kind of cultural scene by going to the bars and checking out the local bands. And I, you know, when I started, that was, I was consumed by it. You know, I was a musician and played locally and knew all these, you know, growing up, I always listened to local, you know, even as a kid, I knew the Raisins and kind of local bands like that. So to me, it was, it just represented the city, you know, it's part of the tapestry of the arts in town, which is obviously like a big part of the city.
We talked to the founders of City Beat earlier, John Fox, Dan Bockrath, and they talked about the early days of creating this publication and the reasons behind it. But you're a newer face to this operation, Tony, as the publisher, and I'm wondering what you see as City Beat's role today, 25 years after they first put out that issue.
You know, I think the role and the mission, looking back on their mission, the same mission is still, you know, at the forefront of our company. We still want to be that and think of ourselves as that voice, that much needed critical voice in a community that is, you know, a champion of the city. A lot has changed. I started back in 2005, so going from 2005 to 2008, 2009. A lot has changed, but a lot has remained the same. You know, like Mike and his the dedication to the music and the local music scene. It's a very important makeup of who we are and what we do. So, you know, we've had to evolve as a company, right? So, being the core of a print media product, Facebook didn't exist in 2005 and six. Well, at least it didn't exist for businesses. You know, we had to shift and change. But what we did was we remained true to that voice. We know that people, you know, they look at City Beat and it's a credible voice and it's authentic. And that's very, very important nowadays, especially more than ever. And so, yeah, that's how I think that, you know, we've, you know, changed as a company, but you know, have also.
Wait, so you've been there for, I guess, half
It'll
the time.
Be 15 years, yeah.
More than half the time. Okay, so 2/3 of the time, if we're doing some quick math, I guess it sounds like maybe 3/5. 3/5 of the time. There it is. So 60%. Very cool. What specific to alternative weekly publications have you observed in that period of time during this period of disruption to traditional media?
You know, I think that the types of people who work for it's passion. You know, there's a lot of passion that goes behind what it is that we do, whether it's arts or news or you know, the restaurants or film. It's passion. Everybody has a passion for it, and that voice that they want to be. A voice of the greater community, and we have that platform to do that.
But what about the business side of things?
The business side of things.
How have you been able to adjust that to stay both relevant, but also out of bankruptcy? You know, a lot of alt weeklies with much more nationally prominent brands have folded recently.
Absolutely, and I think you know, a lot of credit goes to John and Dan and. They evolved as a company when we needed to look at diversifying our portfolio of offerings, right? So what is that? And they looked at, well, why are people utilizing us? Well, we have an audience that they're trying to reach through events. So maybe we should look at doing events. They took over the Midpoint Music Festival back in 2008. And that was, we'd always done happy hours and different events like that, but from a business perspective, like turning an event into a part of the business model, Midpoint was really that first, okay, let's see if we can do this. And we have the means to an audience that is interested in this type of event, and it worked. Unfortunately, you know, times change and the festival scene has evolved and we ended up selling Midpoint, but it launched us into a series of other events. For example, our Best of Cincinnati used to be a happy hour for 200 people. And there was, you know, free alcohol or, you know, appetizers for a couple hours and people would come and then they'd leave. And that was it. And then we thought, John thought, like, let's turn this into a value. Let's create a value. Let's create a ticket price for this and curate the best of Cincinnati and celebrate the issue release in a way that has value. And sure enough, we had it at Memorial Hall and 500 people showed up and sold out. And then we moved to the Berkey Electric Warehouse the next year and then the casino and then the Phoenix. And it's just evolved over time. And so events is how we've really tried to, you know, it's not only generating new streams of revenue, but also connecting with new potential clients and partners. You know, and everything that we do, we try and provide results, whether in the form of marketing to a group of people who are coming to a music festival or a Best of Cincinnati event, or, you know, things such as Greater Cincinnati Restaurant Week or Cincinnati Burger Week, where it drives consumers into these establishments in a slower time period, generates meaningful revenue for them, and also generates new relationships for us. And we have an audience that we can you know, tap into. And they've been very, very successful.
In addition to all these new business models that you've introduced, you still have the old-fashioned print edition, which we can pick up right outside our studio every a couple of weeks now, I guess. You're bi-monthly?
We went to a bi-weekly format back in October, and that was, you know, it wasn't something that happened overnight. That was about 4 years in the making. You know, our last parent company, Salcom Communications, had always talked about, you know, how people were consuming. They looked at the monthly model, and we're not a monthly. We need to be on the streets on a weekly basis. In our industry, in the alt weekly industry, we look at the Seattle Stranger as a pioneer. They, you know, like us, saw events are thriving, and we need to diversify and go into events and generate new streams of revenue. And they, back in 2017, they launched a biweekly format in anticipation of the way people are consuming content differently. And so we talked to them. We did a lot of, you know, research and number crunching and things like that. And under our parent company, Euclid Media Group, we're one of seven publications. Our sister publication down in San Antonio went to a biweekly format at the beginning of the year to great feedback and great success. So we, you know, the idea is that the content is broadened. There's 2 weeks of content. The cover story is the same, you know, for those 2 weeks. Obviously, that's the main difference. But the content's broadened. The page count is higher. And it's been very well received so far from advertisers and readers alike. And, you know, I think that change is hard. It definitely is different. But we have to be real with ourselves, too, in 2020 coming up, that people consume content differently. It's just the reality of the day and age that we're in. And we can still provide that audience that wants that physical copy, and they do. They do. The papers don't come back to the office, and that's a great, you know, testament to what Mike and the editorial team and Maya and Nick and Mackenzie and everybody has done. But we also deliver that content in a digital format and more frequently, more daily online at citybeat.com. So, you know, there's a lot has changed in that, but the mission is still the same, whether it's weekly or biweekly, to be a champion of Cincinnati.
Tony Frank is the publisher of City Beat. Mike Breen is the managing editor and the music editor. And thanks to both of you for being here on the occasion of City Beat's 25th anniversary.
Thank you so much for having us, Michael.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. City Beat is celebrating its 25th year, and one of the most popular voices from that publication's more than two decades of existence has been Kathy Wilson, author of the column Your Negro Tour Guide. And joining me now is Kathy Y. Wilson. She was the columnist behind City Beat's Your Negro Tour Guide. She's on the phone with us today. Kathy, thanks so much for the time.
My pleasure.
I have talked to some people behind the formation of City Beat as we prepare for today's show, and I learned that there is a story, of course, behind the name of your column, and I was hoping that maybe you would share that with us.
Sure. Every good title has a story. So I was freelancing for City Beat while I was still on staff as a reporter and columnist at the Hamilton Journal News. I started there in 94, left in 99, but in the meantime, I was doing some freelance work for City Beat. So while I was at the Journal News, I was the only black reporter on staff. And at the time, I think I was the only black person, period, in that whole building. And I had some you know, run-ins with editors. They were assigning me to black stories. I'm doing air quotes now, listeners. and whatever black stories means to an editor, they would try to assign me those stories, send me as an introductory Negro on in black neighborhoods for white reporters. It was really going sideways. At the time, I was growing dreadlocks, and a white photographer touched my hair without asking me and then wiped his hands on his pants. And so I stood up in the newsroom and said, "Hey, listen, I'm not your Negro petting zoo. Don't think that you can just come over here and touch me and rub my head, you know, and everything's okay." And so that was the beginning of my race-based anger. And then that somehow morphed into your Negro tour guide in that newsroom. So then I started full-time at City Beat. I quit that job at the Journal News after 5 years, gave myself a month to pay off my bills. John Fox, who started City Beat, had been telling me all along, "I want a column. We're not sure how we're going to treat it. I want a column. Just be standing by. I want a column." So I wrote a few evergreen pieces for him, and they were all terrible. The best one was called The Big Red Machine, about how Cincinnati segregates itself on opening day. And he said, "Now, what are we going to call this column? I'd like one name week in and week out." So while I was marinating on that, a reporter at City Beat in the newsroom, Darlene D'Agostino, who is still my good friend, was listening to hip-hop. She was just getting into hip-hop. And she used to ask me questions in the newsroom, like, "Why do they say, you know, shout out to Brooklyn, you know, shout out to Bed-Stuy, or, you know, they call another rapper's name." And I was trying to explain that to her, and I got aggravated, and I said, "Listen, Darlene, I'm not your Negro tour guide." And she said, that's it right there. And I said, "What's it?" She said, "That's your column. That's the name of your column, your Negro tour guide." And so I pitched it to John, and he didn't really, took a little convincing because he didn't get it at first. And he thought, "Well, are you going to explain it every week?" And I'm like, "No, it's like a bus. You pull up, and if you're not there on time, you get left. And, you know, you wait for the next one, and the next one is next week." And it stuck. And that's the story behind your Negro tour guide, Darlene D'Agostino. I don't know where I originally heard your Negro tour guide. I just was so aggravated with the racial politics in newsrooms that I was Negro petting zoo. And then that somehow moved to quit asking me black questions, you know, not your Negro tour guide, and it stuck.
I have many more questions about your column, but you'll excuse me while I pick my jaw up off the floor after your experience at the Journal News with the petting zoo situation. That is surprising.
I'm laughing now, but there was nothing funny about that. And that's what I think millennials would call a microaggression, but I used to call it lynching. I used to call it, "Well, I got lynched today." You know, I would come home and be talking to my friends. And I was living in Walnut Hills that whole time and commuting. And so it was like I was straddling two worlds. And I'd be talking to my Cincinnati friends. I'd be like, "I got lynched today." And they'd say, "What happened?" You know, and I'd it wasn't in the newsroom. It was somewhere on my beat in the city. It just was sideways. But I love that experience. I wouldn't trade it.
When I talked to John Fox and Dan Bockrath, the original co-publishers of City Beat, they mentioned that your Negro tour guide often got the most response, whether it was back in the analog days of people, I guess, having to send letters in, or in the digital sphere where people could leave comments more immediately. Why do you think that was?
Because people still are thirsty for the truth. People want the unexpurgated truth. And somehow the American media has talked itself into believing that people want things sugarcoated. People want the truth. And I'm going to speak very frankly. Black people want it like sugar in the raw. Black people want it, especially in this city and especially at that time. You have to imagine Over the Rhine is Over the Rhine and not as the, Disneyscape that it is now. You have to imagine black people being afraid to encounter the police, as they are nationally now. Cincinnati was in on the ground floor of that kind of relationship. You have to imagine people being so angry and aggravated that they would storm City Hall and take over city council meetings. You go to a city council meeting now, and you would not even imagine. It's so polite. You would never imagine that. People taking over, shutting the mayor down, yelling and screaming, you know, picket signs. And people are looking to the media to say, where's that story? Where's that voice? Where's my anger? And, you know, this was way before everybody, you know, was the handheld cameraman and everybody was doing all the citizen reporting, which is fantastic. But this was way before that. So, you know, I just felt a freedom, a liberation, a responsibility, and strangely, no pressure. Not the only pressure I felt was to be excellent, and that's on myself. I always want to write excellent, well-structured sentences and have a really great idea and that I can attack in a way that's original. But I didn't feel any pressure to, like, represent black people or represent women or represent anybody. So the unspoken thing with the title of the column was actually a hidden knot. I'm actually not your Negro tour guide. I always spoke for myself.
Was there any particular moment or column out of the many that you penned and crafted so well? Is there any one that stands out in your mind, either as a moment of pride in the way that you wrote it or as a memory of what created the most response?
I didn't keep track of the responses. It was really later for me when someone on staff told me, your column is getting the most hits, or your name is getting the most hits of what people are looking up or what people are looking for, or letters coming in. I would say like a bunch of those early ones in the early 2000s were just crap. They were terrible. In fact, I cringe if I have to look at them for any reason now. All of the riot-related columns I'm very, very proud of. I have taught those columns in college classes at the University of Cincinnati, because that's a document. Those columns collectively are a living document to a time and place that I hope this city never returns, and they stand alone by themselves. You can read them by themselves and know exactly who the characters were, who the players, what the issues, the geography of the city, the anger, the passion.
Well, let me ask you this as we start to wind down this conversation that I could probably enjoy for much longer. your voice isn't really contributed to City Beat with quite the frequency. It's more of an intermittent contribution. I'm wondering what you think of the Cincinnati media landscape lacking a regular voice similar to yours.
Well, my friend Nick Schwartzell, who writes a lot of copies of the news editor now, when he tells me in text exchanges that, somebody asked me about you today, or when I say that I write for City Beat, people, the first thing people say is, Kathy Y. Wilson, where is Kathy Y. Wilson? And I shun that. That is not false modesty. That is me feeling like I did my job. I put in my time there. I left a legacy. I don't overinflate my importance to anything. So looking at the landscape, it's blighted. This is a terrible market for media. It's a terrible, there are no jobs. There's no growth. There's a monopoly of voices. And there is no one singular voice that's really standing out. I think Nick Schwartzell has it on lockdown. At City Beat, he covers this city like one person should not even be able to. Tireless. Good stories, the big stories, the little stories, the neighborhood stories. He's killing it. But that voice of a columnist, that city voice, it doesn't exist. Sadly, it doesn't exist. And I think the main problem for City Beat is they can't afford to pay that singular voice. Not even, not, not, pulpit. It's not even a living wage, and that's sad. That's sad. That's you know, because of ad pages and ad revenue and, you know, shrinking paper and, you know, the paper costs, and just American newspapers are just in trouble. And we're actually very, very fortunate to still have an alternative newspaper in this city, because thousands have died across the country. And we should be very, very proud.
Kathy Y. Wilson was one of the most prominent voices featured in City Beat's 25-year history. She was the columnist behind your Negro tour guide. Kathy, thank you so much for taking some time to talk to us about it today.
My pleasure. Thank you for asking.
City Beat has also played a significant role in covering the arts scene. Rick Pinder has been there since the beginning. He joined me earlier, too, to talk about that. Rick Pinder is a contributing editor and the theater writer for Cincinnati City Beat. Rick, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
I want you to take us back to, 1994 and the first edition of City Beat. How did you end up with the task of providing their arts coverage?
Well, I actually had written for Everybody's News previously, which was another alt news weekly that was around. And several of the people who started the paper, including John Fox, who was the first editor of City Beat and the co-publisher, had been at Everybody's News. And he said, hey, would you come over and write about theater for us? So that's really how I began. Now, in 1994, there was not a ton of local theater. Of course, the Playhouse was here, and Ensemble Theater was producing shows, but there wasn't much beyond that. That was actually the year that Cincinnati Shakespeare, in a previous incarnation, they called themselves the Fahrenheit Theater Company at the time. They were just getting started. No theater was still a couple of years away from getting going. So I sort of feel, I can't say that City Beat nurtured the theater scene in ways that made it grow. I think that happened sort of organically, but we covered it and made a lot of people aware of what was going on.
Well, I can tell you as a longtime participant in the local theater community, as a performer and behind the scenes guy, that I think that is a fair point to make. And that's what I wanted to talk to you about is, you know, you don't get a lot of mainstream arts coverage from the local television stations. You get some from the daily newspaper, of course, but you can never really get enough of it if you're an arts enthusiast. And so I wanted to talk specifically with you about how you see the role that an alternative weekly plays in a community, specifically City Beat in Cincinnati, as it relates to theater.
Well, over the years, we really tried to comprehensively cover the professional theater scene locally. We didn't do so much with community theater, although some community theaters that are adventurous in what they perform, we were eager to cover. Part of our rationale for how we covered things was if a show would run long enough that we could write about it in print and people could take a recommendation and go to see it, then we would do that. If it was just one weekend, well, then that didn't make much sense for us to write about something that you couldn't go to see. So community theaters have rather short runs, maybe two weekends, maybe three. But unless they were doing something out of the ordinary, I would probably let a lot of them go by. I did often try to cover. They always do a big competitive festival at the end of the year to send on to a statewide competition. I would try to cover those. But during that time, we ended up with a couple of really great local professional theaters. I mean, during that period in the early 2000s, the Cincinnati Playhouse won the Regional Theater Tony Award. Ensemble Theater developed a reputation for premiering work that had been on Broadway or off-Broadway just the previous season. So all of those things, and we tried to cover all of that. In particular, we tried to do a lot of that with the Cincinnati Entertainment Awards, which recognize music, which is a competition that continues. But for about a dozen years, we did the CEAs and really, I think, brought a lot of people to the brought their attention to the theater scene locally.
And I know that the acting community loved those. It was always a great honor to receive a nomination to celebrate with your castmates and that. And I think that the point that you just made about your editorial decisions, like you can't get to something because you're a weekly. And back then, you know, even before the internet was available where you could produce something daily, you had to wait till Wednesday for the new City Beat to come out to read the review,
That's right.
The only way you were going to get reviewed by City Beat was if you were running for 3 weeks. I think that affected the business decisions of a lot of the small companies.
I suspect that's true.
Yeah, you're, because you are talking about this era in which the theater scene locally exploded.
You know, Michael, it's an interesting thing. I talk to people. I'm a member of the American Theater Critics Association, and I talk to people in larger cities, and they really try to draw a line between being friendly with the theater community. In New York City, for instance, the people who review for the New York Times, they don't hang out with the theater people. You know, they at least want to say they maintain objectivity. Locally, there was no way to do that. I knew people. I reviewed them frequently. And frankly, I'm a theater enthusiast. I wanted people to go to see good theater. So that was always my objective in writing reviews. And of course, if something wasn't perfect, I would write something and say, you know, here's what to expect when you go to see this. Maybe a show is not a well-oiled machine, but maybe it has an outstanding acting performance in it that makes it worth seeing. So I always tried to do the glasses at least half full, if not more so.
You were always gentle. I recall being in a few duds that you wrote of at least some fair things about. So we certainly appreciate that as well. You're also, let's talk about the evolution of the presentation of arts coverage through the alternative weekly medium, because to go back to the late 90s, when I first started reading it, coming of age and trying to get into theater, you had to get City Beat to know what shows were coming up and where to audition. And that was always in the paper. But that's not really a necessary component of it anymore, because you can find that information directly from theater companies on social media, other organizations and publishers putting stuff out. Yeah. How have you seen the coverage of the arts community in City Beat evolve over this digital age?
Yeah. Well, you know, all print media have been somewhat beleaguered over the last decade or so, and many of them, at least like major dailies, have really cut back on their arts coverage. We have tried with City Beat to sustain the level of attention that we always provided with our coverage there, but City Beat is now publishing a little less frequently, about twice a month now, not every week. But we do also have the advantage of being able to post reviews online. So we are still trying to cover almost everything, at least at the four major theaters. That would be the Playhouse, Ensemble, No Theater, and Cincinnati Shakespeare. We are trying to put out reviews of all of those sorts of things.
Okay, Rick Pinder, in our final minute together, give me your understanding of the impact of City Beat on Cincinnati.
Well, I think that City Beat has provided an alternative voice in both news coverage, arts coverage, music, all of those kinds of things that if it were not there, we would not have.
Rick Pinder is an arts contributing editor and theater writer for Cincinnati City Beat. He's also the author of 100 Things to Do in Cincinnati Before You Die, which has a new second edition out, available where books are sold. Rick, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you, Michael.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Elise Meckler. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstrow. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.